How do you build a high-performing culture? This is Culture Architects, candid conversations with extraordinary leaders sharing their biggest successes, failures, and lessons learned on their culture journeys. Here's David J. Friedman.
Welcome back to my conversation with Horst Schultze, one of the founding members of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel Company. Horst is an absolute legend and a leader in the hotel world, and he's been credited with transforming the approach of service and hospitality across lots of different industries. Horst, you had a remarkable career, and you were mostly focused on the hotel industry. I'm curious, do you think that the same principles that you've taught in the past for hotels and that we talked about in part one, do you think those apply just as much in any other business, or is that really unique to service industries like hotels?
It applies to any company. Kind of in a way, everybody calling me, so many people calling me now to make speeches or consult, people all of a sudden becoming aware what drives customer loyalty is not a product. Customer loyalty is created by a relationship. And that means service. Of course, product cannot be ignored. I'm not saying that for heaven's sake. But service, relationship. In fact, there is a survey, a pretty new survey, about a year and a half old, that studied the market as a whole out there. And we learned that 70% of the market says, I will buy your product, even if I could buy it for less next door, the same product. I buy it from you if you give me good attention. That means good service. Mm-hmm. And good service means good relationship. That's an interesting thing. So how do you become loyal to a shoe store? You're related, like shoes. You become loyal because of the shoes? No, you become loyal because how they treat you there, how they respect you, mm-hmm. how they know what you want, which all that is called service, attention, relationship. That is why today people know that's how I'm going to hold customers. That's how I create loyal customers.
Mm-hmm. Of all the companies that you've worked with, so outside the hotel chain, as you said, you give speeches, you do consulting. I know you've worked with Chick-fil-A. Of all the companies you've worked with, which one would you say stands out the most to you that perhaps you're the most proud of in terms of how they've been able to adopt some of your philosophies and have created a great brand?
Right now, there's a small bank company in Texas. Mm-hmm. And I know they have, because they have taken everything that I teach and applied it very much so. And I know there will be a leading financial institution in America in a few years. Or another company, Shen Medical. I worked with them a few years now. In fact, Forbes wrote them up as the medical company that is changing medical service around the world. And they will. And it's happening. They're changing it. And it's all service related. So I'm very excited about that because we serve, in Shen Medical, we serve all the people in poor neighborhoods. But we're changing Medicare patients, which normal doctors don't want to serve because they may lose money with it. But we learned how to do it right, how to serve them right, how to care for them right. And we make money because if we keep them well and healthy, isn't that something else?
Imagine that concept.
That's a new concept. Doctors who make people feel well, and make them well. Yeah, that's right. And that's how we make money. If we don't keep them well, we lose money. So, very happy, very excited to work with those wonderful people. I'm not doing it. I'm only advising and so on. Mm-hmm. Or this little bank who I just know because of the caring and the service that they adopted, caring for their people, caring for their customers, that there will be a leading financial institution in America, and they're well on the way of doing that. What I would have referred to as a lousy little bank in Texas.
So let me ask you this, of course. You and I talked about this a little bit when we were together before. There are some people who think that working on these service things, I think of it more broadly as I call it culture, because that's to me what it really is. It's creating a culture in which people operate in a certain way. That working on this kind of stuff you know, gets in the way of us making money, that, you know, where's the return on investment of this? And I know you have a point of view that if you do the right things, the money will follow. Talk to me a little bit about your philosophy there.
Well, it's stunning to have those beliefs. And I got, the question when I started this to drive this home, here's what we're going to do. And there were actually questions. Emmanuel, what you have to stand here, as Ritz-Carlton, for example, that, but all hotel companies, we don't own hotels. We manage hotels for others on long-term contracts. Okay. And they come back and say, well, you know, you can save money over here and there. Yeah. But if I give the right product, like right service, I create loyal customers. And loyal customers, and here's what they say, the survey, you can charge more for the same thing. It is making money. It's concentrating, unlike most company, it's concentrating on what makes money, not concentrating on the money. Mm-hmm. If I concentrate on the money, I start taking away from the customer more and more in order to save. If I concentrate on the product, I still have to be efficient and save on how I produce it, but not on the product itself, on the outcome. Mm-hmm. And besides, now here's the real key. It really doesn't cost anything to be nice and care and so on. You know, it is this silly notion that that costs money. I don't get it. I mean, it's a silly notion.
Yeah, and yet there are many who are looking at certainly private equity. The clients we talk to, private equity comes in and they've acquired this company, and all they want to know is how do we create transactions that generate more revenue and more profit.
Listen, I have been on those boards. Don't kid yourself. And the CEO, in fact, wrote a book and said our most important asset are our employees. I was on the board for many years. We never talked about employees. In fact, it was a necessary evil. In fact, it's not about was never. They only talked about manipulation of money and another brand and how to borrow the money and how to blend and how to the stock market, and that's what we talked about in the board. We never talked about customers or employees. Come on, let's be honest.
So, you recently wrote your book "Excellence Wins."
Yeah.
Why did you decide to sit down and write that?
First of all, I mean, a couple of reasons. First of all, Stephen Covey, whom I really liked and we became good friends, urged me nonstop to write it. Urged me, in fact, called me one day. I was driving home in a car. My telephone goes, and Stephen on telephone, and he said, "Horst, I'm really disappointed in you." That's how he told me. And I said, "Why are you disappointed? I'm telling you for years to write the book. You own it to people to write your book." I said, "Stephen, I promise you now I will." I started to forget it, and Stephen died, passed away. And I felt so bad, and because he told always I want to write a foreword, and I felt so bad, and so I said, so I promised him. When I heard the day that he passed, I said, "Steve, I promise you now I'm going to write it." And then I thought, what I'm going to do? Because I read a lot of business books, and usually I finish them half and put them away. It gets kind of boring with charts and stuff. And it's boring. And I thought to myself, how am I going to do this so young people will actually read it? I have to tell the story around the decisions you have to make in business. And so I'm going to write it so that young people read it and know they can do it too. And frankly, I have to be very honest now, don't anybody get insulted. When a CEO reads it, I want them to feel a little bit embarrassed that they manage money rather than manage the product. Mm-hmm. I want them to feel embarrassed a little bit. I want them to see it, what we're all doing, because we get applauded if we save a few cents this year. This reporting to Wall Street quarter, if we save the cent or whatever, we get applauded. So we do what we get applauded, and I want them to feel bad about it for a moment. And long term, you're going to make it by being excellent. But 3 months is not long term, you know?
Right. The things that I teach, I've shared before, and most of our audience knows, we call them fundamentals, is my version of what you call basics. And there's a fundamental that I wrote many years ago in my first company that the title of it, it was called Practice A-Plusness as a Way of Life, A-plus being like the highest of all standards. And in my current company, in our current version, I've just retitled it and we call it Make Quality Personal. And it's really what you're talking about. It's this idea that we do quality because it defines us, because just it isn't even necessarily quality for the result as much as it is quality because it defines who you are as a person. That if you look at everything you do and say, my name's on that thing, my signature's on that, it's going to be the best I can make it because that's just who I am. A whole lot of good stuff comes from that.
Yeah, well let me break it down in a little bit different way, because I always talk about excellence and mention excellence. My book is Excellence Wins and so on. But what is excellence? Excellence is never an accident. It's always the result of high intent and hard work. What do I want to accomplish in what I'm doing? Do I have my high intent with Ritz-Carlton or with Capella was, I want to be the best hotel company in the world. That's high intent. Then I have to ask myself, as I said before, is this good for all concerned? Once I determine yes, I have no more right to compromise it. Now, take that somewhere else. What is excellence in a person or in a thing? In a thing I have in front of me, for example, an iPhone. Excellence in a thing is anything. If excellence in anything is if it works well for what it was created. What about a human being? A human being, excellence is, and that's kind of referring to what you said a minute ago, in human being, excellence is if I do my very best in the functions that I fulfill. I'm not perfect, but I'm doing my very best. But also, as a human being, is if I do my very best in my relationships with people. And that is service, by the way, is relationship. Mm-hmm. Saying hello, saying I'm happy to do that, and so on and so on. And excellence as a human being is that if I do my very best morally and ethically, if in those three areas in life I do my very best, I'm a person of excellence. Now, I have to try and improve those three areas, just like a human being cannot stand still, a human being has to improve. So how to improve it best and easiest is if I question myself, maybe once or twice a week, how could I do my function even better than I'm doing? How can I tweak it? How can I do better in what I'm functioning? And in relationship, you should ask yourself four times a day, how could I do it better? After you had a meeting, how could I have done that better? After you passed somebody and said hello, how could I have said better hello? If you do that, you continuously improve. Needless to say, you have to question yourself, am I an honorable, moral human being, and improve that part.
Sure. All right, let me ask you one or two last questions, Horst. So you've had an amazing career, obviously. You've had so much success, which you've worked hard and earned.
Yeah.
Somewhere along the line, you had to have made some mistakes, some things that you said, oh my God, in retrospect, that was stupid. At the time, I thought I was being smart. What's one of the biggest mistakes you made and what you learned from it?
Come on, the mistakes every day. I mean, that is, but let me tell you, more a funny one than a big one.
Okay.
That really,
okay.
So we started Ritz-Carlton. And now all of a sudden we get the first potential international deal in Cancun. Mm-hmm. And the Mexican owner comes to us, and he has some key potential Japanese investors. He asked me to come in and speak to them about what it would mean to have a Ritz-Carlton in Cancun. Now, our name was not known yet at the time. We just had a few hotels in America, and here's a potential to increase. I came back from Europe. I flew back from Europe in the morning to New York, took from there the plane to Cancun. Now, I was on the way now, and in Europe, I had a one-day meeting. I got the day before to Europe, had a meeting, flew back. I was dead tired coming back to Cancun, going into the meeting with those 30 Japanese investors. Now, I'm going in there and telling them why they should invest in Cancun. But what did I do? I went up and said, now, we here, this is the ideal market for us to grow in. We know the success it would be to be in Acapulco, here in Acapulco. What better place for us to stay, this place in Acapulco? And everybody's looking at me funny. And he said, and what better place for you to invest in a hotel in Acapulco, because this is the market. And everybody looks at me funny. And when I was finally finishing, he said, the owner comes to me and said, what's the matter with you? We are in Cancun. You kept on saying Acapulco. And I thought, I'm going to die. No, but mistake. My goodness, if you run a company, build a company from nowhere, you are making so many mistakes. In fact, the first 2 years were nearly disastrous. The way we, for example, the way we advertised. We advertised our luxury that we had. Our luxury, we had the most luxury, and we had a hard time. Now, how would I convince a middle management manager that fills out his expense account and says, I was staying in Ritz-Carlton when we talk about luxury? And the manager said, why do you stay in Ritz-Carlton? Well, because somewhere else where you pay less. So we had to learn and say, we are not about luxury. I talked about reliability. You can count on us. You can count on our attention. You can count that you have the reservation. We can count that we are safe. You can count that we are clean. So that the manager can go back and fill out an expense account and say, I'm staying in Ritz-Carlton because I can count on them. So little things and very refined things and many. I tell the story, the first hotel, just get this. That's when you don't listen to your market. The first hotel we opened here, I was proud to put in this new plastic cards lock system, wing cards they were called, safe, secure. I put it in, and the customers said, and then at the same time we told everybody we are luxury. And the first customers come in and say, you give me a plastic card? What kind of hotel are you? That's your key? And you say you're luxury? So we had to change all locks. Use hard keys again. Wow. And guess what? 3 years later, when people got used to the plastic card, said, why are you giving me a hard key? This is so dangerous. What if I lose and somebody comes in my room? So we changed the locks again to cards. I can write books about the mistakes I made.
As long as you learn
from them and you correct them and you refine them, you continuously improve. That's what you do. You continuously study your mistakes. Why did we make and eliminate the root causes and so on? Hiring the wrong person, having bad employees. Whose fault is it? The employee? No. The employee can't help it that he was raised wrong by his mother. But you were the dummy that hired them. Change your process in selecting, change your process in teaching, and so on. You have to accept that everything goes wrong. Don't blame somebody else. Learn from it. Find the root cause, correct it.
Got it. All right, I have two last questions for you. First question, you created hotel properties all over the world. A question I get often asked is, with our fundamentals, how does it vary when you are in different countries where they have their different cultural norms? You and I talked about this a little bit before in a previous conversation about these 20 service standards, these basics. Are they the same everywhere, or are there some countries where, hey, we don't do it that way?
If you think about it, this is a fascinating subject. If you would analyze this, I look at it so many times. When I hear so much that we talk about race and culture and all that stuff in society talking about. Well, hi guys, hello. I worked in five continents, in Africa, in Asia, in Europe, in Berlin, in Philadelphia, all kind of different places and all kind of different race. Guess what? It was all the same. People want to be respected. People want to be part of something. People want to have purpose. The guest wants to be respected. It was all the same, and the results were all the same. There was no difference.
Do you think do you think, though, just to, not to interrupt you there, but when we talk about people all want to be respected, certainly that's true, but how one culture might define what constitutes respect could be different than how a different culture would define
that. Yes. Oh, I can tell you a fascinating incident I had when I opened Osaka. We were mock training, you know, we were mock checking in, and I opened every hotel around the world myself. I was any hotel that we took over or opened new, I was there to take it over or opening it to be part of the training for the employees, period. And so I was in Osaka, in Japan, our first hotel in Japan. And in fact, we were teaching the front desk, and I was staying there with our owners of the hotel. And I look at it, and we had taught very careful, because of behavioral analysts tell us how important it is to make the right impression when somebody comes within 10 feet.
Mm-hmm.
Because that, when you come within 10 feet of somebody, subconsciously, you make a decision about them. But they're about you too. You know? Mm-hmm. So we had taught everybody around the world, if a guest comes within 10 feet, particularly in a reception in the beginning, you look in the field, in the eye, and say, welcome, good morning, good afternoon. Don't say hi, because if you say hi, you say we're equal. If you say welcome, good morning, you're saying I respect you. And at the same time, you're saying I'm professional. Good. But now here in Japan, what do? They look down. They don't look him in the eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness. And say, oh, my goodness, how am I going to handle that? Here we are teaching around the world, and now all of a sudden, hardly against our heavy teaching everywhere. I stayed there and watched it, and I said, and finally I said, stop, everybody. We're going to change it. And you're going to look them in the eyes. And my owner told me, Mr. Schulze, you're in Japan. I said, yeah, I know, but this is a Ritz-Carlton. I respect everything in the culture. And we will do everything, but this is Ritz-Carlton culture. And guess what? 30% of our customers are international. And guess what? Some of your Japanese customers have experienced us and will stay here because they experienced a Ritz-Carlton somewhere. And he said, no, that doesn't go. But we did it. I said, I'm going to do it. I'm sorry. So I taught those young ladies, and I spent really time in it. They have a hard time doing that. This was a cultural change for them.
Mm-hmm.
People in the arms. And guess what? A year later, everybody in Japan was voted the best hotel in Japan. Everybody talked about the how friendly the hotel is. So they accepted it. They accepted the nice welcome. So I had to change. But generally, mind you, before we opened a hotel in any location around the world, outside of the United States, We had a cultural teaching of that location. Mm-hmm. Nobody was transferred. Nobody went there to teach or be part of that hotel without going through that teaching. I went through it. I had in my suitcase a file for every hotel I went to visit. And before I landed in a plane, I read again the cultural do's or don'ts of that culture. Yes, I respected that very much, but sometimes I had to insist on the Ritz-Carlton culture.
Got it. All right, last question for you, and it takes off from that. And that is something that you said to me when we were together last, stuck in my mind, and I want you to expand upon this for our audience. And you said to me, at least as I heard it, you said that one of the most important responsibilities of a leader is that as a CEO, you and other CEOs, we are responsible for the standards of the company.
I believe that the CEO, the leader of the company, I have to delegate nearly everything, because I'm not in Berlin serving the customer. I'm not in Berlin fitting into the community. I'm not in Shanghai doing that. I mind you, when you're in five continents, I had to learn to delegate everything. But what I didn't delegate are two things. That is the vision of the company and the standards of the company. While I want you to be yourself in Shanghai serving the customer, while I want you to respect the community, or in Osaka, or in Bali, or wherever, or in Philadelphia, or in Atlanta, doesn't matter where, I respect the community, I want you to everything. But at the same time, I want you to respect the standards of service of excellence of the organization, and I am owning that. And I will not let, cannot let you change that or do anything about it. I own it. I own the vision of the company. That's our vision. We will be the leader in the world and nothing else called. You have to establish that consequently you're the leader locally. But I will not let you change that and say, well, while we are one of the best, that's not acceptable to me. I said we are the very best, period, over, out. Because I know that serves all concerned who I am responsible for, period. And the standards, you cannot limit the standard because you think it is maybe a little bit easier to serve it on paper plates or whatever. Mm-hmm. That's not our standard. Our standard is set and you cannot go away from that. But you can be creative around it. But that's the framework that you have to live in under.
That's really important for leaders to hear that and to understand that. You know, it's one of the things that I find commonly among many leaders is in their desire to be liked, to have everybody agree with them or to feel a part of something, I have witnessed often some leaders who are at some level perhaps afraid or not willing to stand up and say, you know what, these are the standards. This is how we do things. And if that doesn't work for you, you probably should work somewhere else because this is what we do here.
In order to be nice or they're afraid, they're not afraid. What they really do, it's really a selfish thing. I come to that conclusion. Mm-hmm. It's really a selfish thing. Well, I'm going to be nice so people are nice to me because I want them to be nice to me. I want them to care for me. But that's not your business. Hopefully they are. Hopefully they will respect you. Hopefully they're nice to you. Hopefully they like you because of the excellence that you're helping to create. Because you as the leader, the most valuable thing that you have is you have the opportunity to positively impact the life of others. But you're not doing that just by being a nice guy. You're doing that by helping them to live within high standards and become human beings of excellence.
That's great.
That doesn't mean you should be a nice guy. But if you're nice by compromising something, you're not nice. It's not nice.
Yeah, that's short-sighted.
Yeah.
Well, Horst, this has been a fascinating conversation. And as I said at the outset, I mean it very honestly when I said that the day that I learned about the Ritz-Carlton Basics and the Daily Lineup, which was in 2003, that I say very honestly, that day changed the course of the rest of my career. It truly led to the creation of the fundamentals, the creation of our weekly fundamental, of the culture-wise system that we teach and have implemented in hundreds and hundreds of companies. So it was foundational for me and for us, and it's impacted so many others. So to have you share your story of the development of that and the things that you've learned and the successes you've had is not only inspiring, but it's an honor to have you. So thank you so much for joining us today, Horst.
Thank you very much, David, and all the best to you. God bless.
His name is Horst Schulze. He's the co-founder of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel Company, and his book, Excellence Wins, is available wherever books are sold. Well, that's it for this episode of Culture Architects. If you enjoy the show, make sure you take a second to subscribe, and that way, whenever we drop a new show, you'll automatically get the notice. Also, if you have a minute, I'd love it if you would leave us a review so that more people like yourself can discover the show. I'll see you next time.
This has been Culture Architects with David J. Friedman. Be sure to join us next time for more insights and wisdom from great leaders from all walks of life. To book David for your events or to learn more about his writing, speaking, or consulting, go to davidjfriedman.com. Culture Architects with David J. Friedman is a production of Forbes Books.